loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Alabama voters caused a stunning upset yesterday in that state's Senate race, handing victory to Democrat Doug Jones over Republican Roy Moore. What does this mean for President Donald Trump, who lost twice, having endorsed Moore in the general election and the incumbent Luther Strange in the Republican primary? And does it mean that Democrats will again become a big tent party welcoming conservatives into their ranks? We are joined from Birmingham, Alabama by Connor Sheets. He's a journalist with AL.com. We're joined in studio by Garland Nixon. He is the co-host of Fault Lines, which you can hear weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 a.m. And we are joined by Mike Hirsch. He is with Progressive Democrats of America. Welcome, all of you. Connor, let's start with you. You're in Alabama. What's the mood?
The mood is, on a large level, surprise. In Birmingham, it's pretty jovial because, large percentage of people here are Democrats and voted Democrat, voted for Doug Jones. I think across the state, some other areas are clearly having some introspection and not quite as happy. But yeah, I'd say Alabama is mostly in a state of shock on some level.
Yeah, Steve Bannon is also in a state of shock because...
Must be.
I mean, wow. When you think about the big losers, Garland, Steve Bannon was all in for Roy Moore, no matter how flawed he was as a candidate.
Yeah, Steve Bannon, and of course his accompanying media outlet Breitbart, because he carried Breitbart along with him. It became the Roy Moore spokesperson in Bannon, and the Roy Moore outreach media outlet in Breitbart. And now both of them are, the only thing they've got left really are the people who are really diehard Moore supporters. They're looking kind of like schmucks to everybody else.
Yeah, Connor, we spoke to you yesterday. You were just on your way down to the Black Belt area, a predominantly African-American area. That was the big question, as we discussed. What would black voter turnout be like? It turned out to be, well, you go ahead and explain it.
Yeah, I mean, so black voter turnout in Alabama was, we're talking about probably the numbers that tipped the election. If you look at the comparison between the black vote and the white vote, there's no comparison, really. That's what drove the results. There's something over 90% voted Doug Jones, I think, among African-Americans in Alabama, and far lower percentage for white voters. And in the Black Belt, I was out, the number of people voting was beyond anything I've seen covering even the Obama election, and that was not in Alabama, but it just seemed that there's such an outpouring of support now that some of these voters who've never really had the ability to vote for a Democrat who could actually win saw this opportunity.
Connor, we saw some huge vote swings, too, in places like Tuscaloosa County and Lee County, where Trump had won by double digits, and then Jones won last night by double digits. Was that the effect of students voting at the major universities there? What do you attribute those wild vote swings to?
Those are some of the hardest things to parse after this election. I think of energy, obviously. I don't know that we can attribute it to students yet, but I think that, just the energy was let out of the sails of the Moore campaign towards the end, right as the Jones energy was lifting. And I think it was just about turnout, in my opinion. I don't really know where that turnout came from in those specific counties, though.
Mike Hirsch, Obama's shocking victory in 2008, of course, there was the overarching economic collapse of Wall Street and the economic contraction, the recession. But there was also huge turnout. It was a big turnout, a lot of energy among young people, and particularly in the black and Latino communities. What does this mean for the Democrats? What does it tell the Democrats? What does it mean not just for Alabama, but nationally?
Well, the so-called Obama coalition won two historic landslides, the two biggest victories for Democrats since Franklin Roosevelt, I think. And part of that was Obama's ability to galvanize support among the groups that you just mentioned, the young people, Latinos, African-Americans, people who unfortunately generally did not turn out in high numbers and didn't turn out in high numbers when Obama wasn't on the ballot in the midterms, which caused the Republican resurgence. And what does this mean for Democrats? I think Democrats have to watch out very carefully not to become overconfident about this. Roy Moore was an absolutely horrendous candidate. He was a kind of one of these things that washed up on the shore that people think were extinct, you know, some kind of throwback living fossil kind of thing. And with Doug Jones, we had kind of almost an Atticus Finch kind of figure, somebody who Southern whites could be proud of and say, you know, here's somebody who prosecuted the Klan for the domestic terrorist bombing. It was really kind of a perfect storm, and the Democrats really needed to thread the needle perfectly in order to win this. They won it by a very narrow margin, and I think that this is not a sign of any kind of a Democratic wave. It's a little bit more like the Cleveland Browns trying to pop a bunch of champagne if they ever win a game, saying that, you know, the long losing streak is over. This is not a time to celebrate. This is a time to do some more soul searching and seeing what Democrats can do in order to win in the South, to make the South at least competitive. And the Democrats still have a very long way to go.
Well, Garland, I want to ask you and Connor the same question. What was it that drove black people to come out in such large numbers in Alabama? What were the specific things that made folks want to come out? Again, the voter turnout in the African-American community, perhaps higher, maybe definitely higher than even during the Obama election. Go ahead, first Garland and then Connor.
I think Connor hit the nail on the head, and I suspected this a while in the last few weeks. And that is, you know, if you are a Democratic voter, period, in Alabama, there are very few opportunities to vote where you feel that your representatives can actually win. So here we had an opportunity for them to vote for someone who had, you know, who probably a legacy that would be a civil rights legacy, you know, not just a legacy of a person who got along or who was welcomed in the black community, but an actually a civil rights legacy. So they get an opportunity now to actually vote and to actually win at a time when I'm sure the people there, you know, the black community is less than thrilled with Donald Trump. And that's what that was about. They smelled blood in the water and it's like, oh, wait a minute, we can win. All hands on deck. This is one that we can take.
Question for Connor. Roy Moore has not yet conceded, and the Secretary of State of Alabama said that it would be extremely unlikely that enough problems would be found to throw the election then back to Moore. At the same time, President Trump already tweeted last night at 11:08 p.m., congratulations to Doug Jones on a hard-fought victory, et cetera, et cetera. So it looks to me like Trump has thrown Moore under the bus and has said, well, he said in the same tweet, the Republicans have another shot at this seat in a very short period of time. That's true. There's going to have to be another election in November for this very same seat. So how does this play out in Alabama? Does Moore run again in the Republican primary, or is he going to be shut out by Alabama Republicans? And are they going to look for somebody more mainstream?
Yeah, so I think on some level that, you know, Roy Moore is sort of going to remain relevant because of the fact that he was able to drive some of these, you know, some of the real conservative camps in the state do really back him pretty strongly. And I'm sure he'll have some sort of persecution complex after this that'll probably continue to drive a certain percentage of people, especially evangelicals and born-again Christians. I don't know that he'll run for Senate again. There's some talk that he'll probably run for governor. He believes that he, you know, is ordained by God to be in a position of power in Alabama and or in the nation or whatever. And I think that that will continue to be a factor. I don't know that he'll ever get elected again, though.
Well, go ahead, Mike Hirsch.
Yeah, I believe that if Doug Jones wants to credibly defend the seat, and you know, most people do, he's going to have to vote in ways that is palatable to the people in Alabama, which is going to be a far cry from a typical Democratic Northeastern or, you know, West Coast senator. And I would watch that voting record very carefully. And from my experience, the Democratic Senate committee will caucus will give him a lot of leeway. Whenever they don't need his vote, they'll let him vote along with the state. And I think that that's another reason why it's premature to start popping champagne corks at this point.
But let me ask you, that implies actually that Doug Jones would move to the right. In other words, because Alabama's to the right of Doug Jones in general. If he does that, there are big issues coming up in the U.S. Senate, including the tax plan. If he moves to the right, won't the very people who were stimulated to come out and vote, who were the decisive factor in Doug Jones' victory, meaning poor people and black people in particular, won't that just be a giant turnoff if they say, hey, we got Doug Jones in, and guess what? Same old, same old.
Yes, it's Connor. I wanted to say, I do not see this huge right, even much of a rightward push from Jones. I mean, Jones ran as a fairly progressive centrist style. I mean, kind of typical Democrat, a little more progressive with, living wage and some of these other things. Clearly he had to run, he had to support guns and that type of thing. But I do see that he'll be a much more left-leaning senator than we've had in Alabama in over two decades. And I think that if he were to start voting with the conservative caucus or anything like that, I think that would absolutely be seen. That would be the end of his political career in Alabama, in my opinion.
Go ahead, Garland.
The other thing is this, under normal circumstances, that would even be possible, I would suspect, because what are we looking at, 51-49 now or something like that? Because the numbers are going to be so close, there are not going to be a lot of areas where he's going to be able to do that, particularly when it gets to the more contentious legislation. So, if you've got five or six different lead one way or the other, there's room for that. But here, there's no room for that kind of stuff. You're going to be either with one caucus or the other, or the other, particularly on these major issues.
John, I think Connor's point is an important point. And revelatory, in fact. I mean, here you had Doug Jones coming out very forcefully, even at the end, about a woman's right to choose. A lot of the sort of right-wing Democrats have shied away from issues like abortion. As a consequence, people who care about abortion rights, who care about women's rights, are not caring that much about them, not that excited about them.
Right.
Maybe Doug Jones is indicating something. A lot of times, let's think about American history. We were in a very conservative, witch-hunting, anti-communist, anti-socialist period in the 1950s. The left disappeared. Where did it resume? Montgomery, Alabama. I mean, the least expected place at all, where the movement of regular people who were impassioned about making a change and long overdue change, that's what got the 60s going. It started in Montgomery. So it's something, the stereotypes are just that. They're stereotypes. There's some element of truth, but a lot of times not true.
Yeah, it's not unusual for states to have one very conservative Republican senator and one very liberal Democratic senator. We've seen that repeatedly over the years. I mean, all through our modern history as well. And there's another point here, too. I think we also need to look at the broader political landscape. Donald Trump is immensely unpopular right now. He's engaged in a civil war in his own party. And we're going to come to a point in the 2018 elections where people may be fed up with the Trump presidency, and they may just sit at home and not go out to vote. And the voters who do go out to vote are the ones who are motivated to defeat the Trump agenda. And so I could see a scenario where, regardless of who the Republicans in Alabama nominate for this seat next year, turnout is such that Doug Jones could actually win it outright.
That's right. Okay, you're listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. We're joined from Birmingham, Alabama by Connor Sheets. He's a journalist with AL.com. We're also joined by Garland Nixon. He's the co-host of Fault Lines, which you can hear every day at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. And we're also joined by Mike Hirsch. He's with the Progressive Democrats of America. Connor, let's go back to you. I want to follow up with John's point. What about the Trump support? Does this indicate that among those who voted for Trump in 2016, that there's disillusionment? I mean, obviously not with everybody, but with some sectors of the Republican base?
So speaking to that, I think that's a little hard to speak to. I actually have something I was going to say. I moved here from New York City 3 years ago, so I'm not the typical Alabama person in that sense. But there's, being in this state, I've pretty much learned, internalized this concept that I think there's the North-South divide, these old stereotypes are kind of super outdated, and that really what we're looking at is more of a class divide and also a rural versus urban divide. And Alabama has four major cities, all full, that vote very progressively, or at least three of them vote very progressively every year. And, you know, for instance, Jefferson County, where Birmingham is, voted in 9 black female judges last year, which is the most of any county, I think, in American history.
Way ahead of New York, so I hear you on that.
Yeah, so I think there's some sort of, I just think that this, sometimes we're trying to divide between North and South and look at these old models. It's actually really, it's really kind of changed. It's not, these old models don't apply in this election in certain ways.
Yeah, and but just take a stab at what about the Trump base in Alabama? In other words, suburban, middle class women, for instance, who might have voted for Trump, who would, one, be horrified by Roy Moore, but also maybe horrified by Donald Trump 1 year into office. What do you think?
I mean, I do think that there's some of that, but I think that more of the revulsion was because of the allegations against Roy Moore. And it seems to me, when you look at the number of write-ins and probably the number of people that stayed home, I would think that those people were more dissuaded, you know, swayed from voting or chose to write in more based on the allegations than anything Donald Trump has done, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Mike Hirsch was getting to earlier, not a time for extreme euphoria on the part of the Democratic Party. But let's turn for a moment, just for a moment, to Virginia. John Kiriakou, you're a Virginian.
I am indeed.
So talk about what happened there.
Well, Democrats won all the statewide races. They won governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. But what was really shocking was that the state legislature went from 66 to 34 Republican to 51-49 Republican, but there are still 3 contested seats. And so what we saw was one of these, you know, once in a generation watershed elections, at least in Virginia. And the Democrats nationally are saying that the Virginia race could be a model for the rest of the country in 2018 and could enable the Democrats to retake not just the House, but state legislatures across the country that were lost to the Republicans during the Obama years.
Yeah, Garland, in other words, a Democratic wave. And I want to go back to the point that Connor made, which I believe is extremely important, is that if the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party elites move or tack back to the center, back to being the party of Wall Street, which of course they are, but in other words, really express themselves and do in the liberal wing like Bernie Sanders or Doug Jones in Alabama, that's going to depress voter turnout. I'm looking at Politico right now. It says Alabama's historic turnout on Tuesday mirrored enormous numbers for Democratic voters in the Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial races, even after the muddy campaigns in all 3 states. And party operatives are now lunging to capitalize on the energy ahead. And they're talking about here in the Politico that this could be an actual wave where the political realignment between the Democrats and the Republicans, of course, Wall Street is still in charge, might significantly change. Do you see that as a prospect?
I think it's possible. Now, a couple of things. Let's not forget that it's not unusual. In fact, it's pretty much the norm that whichever party takes the White House over the past, you know, 25, 30 years, with maybe 2 exceptions, they take a beating in the midterms. So that's pretty much the norm. I felt for quite a while that whichever of the 2 presidential nominees won, that both of them being very unpopular, that their party would take a beating in the midterms. So I think we can see that. Now, look at a couple of things, though. Look at Doug Jones, who ran to the left. Let's look at New Jersey, what happened. In New Jersey, the guy that was ran to the left, he ran for, you know, for $15 minimum wage, marijuana legalization, et cetera.
Medicare for all.
So what we're seeing is that we've got some Democrats that are, even though the party structure may not realize it, we've got some people who are realizing that, you know, you got to do 3 things to win: turn out your base.
What's the 4th thing?
That's turn out your base. Yeah, there we go. And that people are realizing we've had a party that have said, oh, gee, we've got to run to the right and pick up the Republican voters, which is never going to happen. Yeah. And so they're actually running to their base. Their base is showing up. The other base is somewhat depressed for a number of reasons. Suppressed and depressed, how about now? But suppressed for a number of reasons. And the opportunity is there. But the opportunity is there on your side of the aisle, not these knuckleheads that have been trying to steal the votes on the other side of the aisle.
You know, I wonder also if I could add one thing. I wonder if a lot of this can be blamed on on Trump's lack of any real political experience. You remember in the early 1980s when David Duke somehow won the nomination, the Republican nomination to be governor of Louisiana. Ronald Reagan disavowed him immediately, as did the Republican political structure. And Duke lost. If he had won, Reagan had his hands clean. Well, that wasn't the case in Alabama, even though the Republican Party structure disavowed itself. For the most part, of Roy Moore, people like Mitch McConnell, people like Richard Shelby, Trump went all in. He went all in after Strange was beaten in the primary. And now he has this political black eye because he put his own political capital on the line and he lost. Reagan would never have done something like that.
He went all in, too, because he was being partly, at least, because he was being advised by Steve Bannon, who was going all in. It'll be interesting to see whether Trump, having lost big in Alabama and having followed the Bannon strategy, whether he'll throw Bannon under the bus, because that's Trump's style, right? I mean, that's what that's what he does. I mean, Connor, let me ask you about the comparison between Roy Moore and David Duke. David Duke, of course, was the Grand Wizard of the KKK, but Roy Moore's statements, I don't know if he's a member or not a member of the KKK, but some of his statements, many of his statements, his political outlook, his worldview about when he thought America was great, which was, he said, well, we had slavery then. It was about the 1840s. We had slavery, but we had a common purpose. I mean,
families remained together.
Families remained together.
They pick cotton together.
Right.
At different plantations.
Talk about Roy Moore as, in terms of the way he's perceived, at least in the black community or among progressives, on the issue of white supremacy.
Well, I mean, I think Roy Moore definitely was is definitely coming out of that stew of the same type of old Southern, you know, racism that, you know, he couldn't be quite as overt about it, or maybe he just is not quite as overt about it as someone like David Duke. He's clearly signaling to those people, and those people are definitely going to vote for him, people who fall into that category. I was going to say about Donald Trump, though, I think one thing that we're ignoring, I mean, I actually thought it was interesting that he was so forthright about the fact that one of the main reasons, and a lot of Republicans were, that the main reason they wanted Moore in there is just to get the Senate. You know, they weren't saying we care anything about this candidate necessarily. I mean, maybe Trump was towards the end, but I think a lot of it was craven political manipulation. And it was interesting that they were that honest about it. And then that the voters said, actually, we have some standards beyond just that calculation.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, it was naked political calculation because Trump had gone down and supported Luther Strange, who lost to Moore in the primary. So it appeared that Trump preferred him. Again, though, I think it's important that there's the absence of having a politically competent leader for the Republican Party, meaning Donald Trump is not a competent political leader. His policies, from my point of view, are racist and misogynist and xenophobic and, you know, lots of reasons to be against Donald Trump. But there's another thing. Donald Trump seems to be, as a politician, inept, incompetent, maybe just straight out stupid, impulsive, certainly.
And won't take advice from anybody. This is a problem, not just in Washington with many politicians, but especially with Donald Trump. He thinks he's the smartest guy in the room, and it doesn't matter what anybody else advises him. He thinks he knows better, and it's bitten him last night. It bit him with this move of the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and it's going to bite him again in the 2018 off-year elections.
Of course, the immediate thank you or congratulations from Trump to Doug Jones is at least an indication that Trump knows that he doesn't want to hitch his wagon anymore to Roy Moore. Right, Mike?
If Trump wrote that tweet.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. It could be his lawyer.
I didn't notice any misspellings or anything like that. So.
Good point.
A lot of capital letters.
No, that's a good point. It didn't sound like Donald Trump. He doesn't congratulate anybody he loses to. No.
Well, one of the other things we're looking at, you know, relative to what you were just saying is, you know, that he is somewhat of a political neophyte. So therefore, what you have is you have a competition. You have these competitive entities behind him all vying for power. So that's another dynamic you have to take into account. You've got the Bannon people back. And now here we are over a year into his presidency. You had Bannon, who was still in his ear fighting for power. You had the Mitch McConnell people who are surely now to look at Bannon and say, see, we told you not to listen to those people over there. They've led you astray. So even now, a year in, we have power. It may be starting to settle somewhat. You know, we had the generals going on and the mooches coming in. But behind Donald Trump, there's a battle for power and direction as to who gets his ear and who gets to point him in what direction. And I think that's one of the reasons that his presidency has been, you know, he hasn't been able to accomplish any major goals. He hasn't really been able to get any real direction or compass going, because it isn't to some extent, some of it's about Donald Trump's impulsiveness, and others about who gets control, who gets his ear.
I'm looking at Breitbart right now, a website that I try not to go to, but you know, they're saying five things that went wrong for Roy Moore. One, not having a unified GOP mattered. Two, margins of loss in urban counties was too much to overcome. That's a signal like, let's get busy for voter suppression in 2018.
Yeah, really.
And turnout was much higher than predicted, of course. Alabama swing counties. Moore was relying too much on a strong showing in the Wiregrass region. What is that, Connor?
The Wiregrass region, I guess that's some of these low-lying, you know, sort of some of the it's more of the non-urban areas. I'm not exactly sure the exact definition of it, but, you know, it's sort of a broad way to describe some of the more rural areas in Alabama.
Yeah, the one thing that Breitbart doesn't say is their own responsibility for having gone all in, Mike, with Roy Moore, because it seemed like to me that Steve Bannon, having been expelled from the White House, was now going to show Donald Trump and the people who expelled him, I know how to win, you don't. And this was like a big throwdown for Steve Bannon and a big colossal failure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Steve Bannon doesn't seem to do anything by half measures. And he is very bombastic. He was there on the stump. He was clearly a surrogate for Moore, and linked himself to Moore, which is unusual in some ways because Bannon is a self-styled anti-establishment figure, and Moore is kind of an establishment figure. He wasn't anti-establishment in any way, shape, or form. If anything, he was like antebellum establishment, kind of a throwback. But he was definitely not any kind of challenge to entrenched powerful interests. And it's just very curious that Bannon was in for Moore very early and often, and has become an albatross for Bannon now. Bannon doesn't really have anything to bring to Trump to say, look, I told you so. You know, now Bannon looks like he doesn't know what he's doing. Trump has been embarrassed by this, and Trump hates to be embarrassed. So we just wonder if there's a bus big enough to throw out enough people under it for Trump. You know, he might have to get a whole fleet of buses.
Go ahead, Connor. We have 45 seconds before we go to break.
Sure. I would dispute the concept that Roy Moore is not seen as anti-establishment. I think most of the people voting for him in Alabama probably would absolutely characterize him as that. You know, he was taken off the Supreme Court twice for defying the law. People see him as, in the state, people who vote for him see him as fighting back this tide of progressivism that's sweeping the nation. And he was the one who was, you know, going to stand up for the old style rights of people, but not in an establishment sense, sort of from the outside.
Well, you're there. You're in Alabama. And that's the voice of Connor Sheets. He's a journalist with AL.com. We're talking for the whole hour about the stunning victory of Doug Jones in the Alabama Senate race yesterday. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're spending the full hour talking about the Alabama Senate race. Yesterday, Doug Jones defeated Roy Moore. A stunning victory for the Democratic candidate. We're joined from Birmingham, Alabama by Connor Sheets. He's a journalist with AL.com. In studio by Garland Nixon. He is the co-host of Radio Sputnik's Fault Lines, which you can hear weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. And we're joined from Huntsville, Alabama, by Lita Gore. She is also a journalist with AL.com. And in studio, Mike Hirsch. She's with the Progressive Democrats of America. Lita Gore, thank you for joining us in this segment. The last 30 minutes, we've been talking about the various reasons that Doug Jones won, what its impact is on national politics, what its impact is on Steve Bannon and the Bannon-Trump relationship and also on Trump and what it might mean for the 2018 elections. But since you're just joining and we had you yesterday and you were in Huntsville, Alabama, and we ask you who we asked both you and Connor, who did you think would win? Connor ducked the question very deftly. And you, on the other hand, did not duck the question. You made a prediction. Your prediction was that Roy Moore was the likely winner. And I think you thought by 5 to 7 percentage points. Given what has happened, how surprised were you? And what do you think the main reasons are?
Well, that was a good prediction, wasn't it? Well, I think, let me say that I was not surprised, but I was, well, let me say this. I wasn't shocked, but I was surprised. And I think my prediction came from living here my whole life and sort of seeing how we have voted in the past. I think it was an assumption, an incorrect one on my part, that the status quo would sort of hold and Roy Moore would squeak by. But I'll tell you that there was a sort of a steady drumbeat through the day yesterday, and I noticed it first when I went to vote, because I live in North Alabama. We're a military community, suburban area. And I waited in line just like I did for the presidential election, which is unheard of in a, you know, special election Senate in this state.
Right.
And so I talked to a young lady that was standing behind me that drove in from Tuscaloosa to vote. She had waited too late to vote absentee, so she left her final studying, drove to Huntsville to vote, and was driving back that day. She was a young African-American voter, very excited to be there. And I don't know who she voted for, but that sort of energy we just don't see. And so I think that was kind of my first inclination that we were seeing something historic on that particular day. Now, obviously, Jones' momentum had been building in recent days, but I think the first real sign was when those first results started coming in and the rural areas of Alabama started you know, reporting, and we didn't see the separation. And the moment we didn't see that separation for Moore, You knew with Jefferson County and Birmingham still out that Jones was going to take it.
Right, right. It was funny to me that so many of the rural counties came in so quickly with 100% of the votes counted. Lita, I have to tell you, I thought the same thing. As soon as I saw that the race was as close as it was something like 52-48 or 53-47. I thought to myself, as soon as Birmingham and Huntsville and Mobile and some of these other places start coming in, there's no way that Moore can sustain this spread. And sure enough, it flipped at something like 9:30 last night.
Yeah, it did. And what was interesting about that, though, is even before that, if you were watching, you know, the Moore camp, there was this somber tone, because even they couldn't deny that Jefferson County's still coming in, and they knew how Birmingham was going to vote. And so there was sort of this pallor across the whole thing before, you know, an hour before the race was even called, which was just unprecedented for a Republican, you know, political event in this state. And I told somebody, if Jeff Sessions had been on the ballot, or if Luther Strange had even been on the ballot, we would have seen a blip of interest. If Jeff Sessions, he, you know, it would have been 75%. But the fact that the Republicans backed an obviously flawed candidate before the allegations even came out, he was a flawed candidate. It just speaks a lot to some poor decisions on behalf of some local Republicans to go with him and some national Republicans as well.
Well, you're making a point that isn't discussed much, because most people only talk about the allegations, but they forget that during the runoff between Strange and Moore, one of the arguments that was made on behalf of Luther Strange was that there were those Republicans, mainstream Republicans, who feared that without any anything, you know, out of sorts happening, that Moore was vulnerable to Doug Jones, that Doug Jones was in fact for a Democrat in Alabama, that he was a very strong candidate. So there was fear that he could lose before any of this happened. And once that happened, it just kind of sealed his fate.
Absolutely. Well, and it's also important to remember that while it's easy to cast Alabamians as this love affair with Roy Moore, that is not the case. We've twice rejected him for governor. He barely won a state Supreme Court Chief Justice race against a Democrat a few years ago. So the decision by our state Republican Party to stay with him, even when the national Republican Party abandoned him for a period of time, proved disastrous.
Why did they do it?
that I would love for them to answer that question. I think they felt like, I think there was a great sense that if you had an R by your name in this state, you were going to win no matter what. And that was definitely proven wrong. And I think the lesson for our state Republican Party is you cannot just run any Republican and expect to walk away with it.
Well, let's talk about that, Lita. What do you think this means for the state legislature in 2018? Is this excitement for Doug Jones able to translate into excitement for the Alabama Democratic Party? Does the Democratic Party have a chance of picking up seats in what is really a solidly conservative and Republican legislature?
Well, the difference is, while a U.S. Senate race attracts national money and national organization and national attention, local races don't statewide. And the state Democratic Party in Alabama, as far as infrastructure, as far as leadership, is virtually non-existent. And so if you're going to launch a true Democratic movement in the state, it's going to require so much infrastructure work, I'm not sure they can even pull that off. Now, it's interesting to note, though, we have governor's race coming up next year, in 2018 also, and there is a strong Democratic candidate who's Walt Maddox, who's the governor of Tuscaloosa, who's a very Doug Jones-type Democrat. It will be interesting to see how he fares. He may be a better bellwether than some of the others because he's running against a host of strong Republicans.
One of the things I know about, you know, up in Maryland, Maryland politics is when this happened, people start calling for someone's head. Do you think there's, you know, you mentioned there are people that are going to be asking questions of the state party. Do you think that heads will roll as a result of this?
I think there will be, I don't know if it will roll externally, but I imagine internally there are some serious discussions about how this race was handled as far as a state Republican Party, and where do they go from here? Because, you know, to lose a Senate race in this state, for a Republican to lose a Senate race, is unheard of. And so there were some, you know, I'm not blaming all our state Republican Party, but there are certainly some questions they're going to have to look at.
Lita, let's just stay with you for a moment. Earlier, I asked Connor whether, because people are trying to sort of prognosticate and generalize about what this might mean also for national politics, and of course Alabama is particular, the particularities are perhaps are dominant, but nonetheless people are looking for national trends. Did you see yesterday that there was some part of the Trump voter base that voted for Trump in 2016 who did not vote? And is it possible that they did not vote if they did not vote? Not only because Roy Moore's problems as a candidate, but because there may be some decline of support for Donald Trump. Connor wasn't certain about it. I don't think he thinks the information is in yet. Certainly that's what some of the national media are generalizing. What's your take on that?
Well, not just because he's my colleague and a brilliant person, but I agree with Connor. I don't think you can read too many national implications into this race. And the reason I say that is because, well, if Donald Trump ran again tomorrow, Alabama would give him 66% of the vote like they did the first time. I think where you see the disconnect is just like, you know, just like that old saying that all politics were local. This was a local event. And voters rejected Roy Moore. And the thing about it is Donald Trump was not backing Roy Moore from the start. Roy Moore has made some comments about Donald Trump. So there was no great love affair from the start. I think there are Alabamians who are upset that Trump has not moved quicker on certain things than he has and not been able to accomplish more than he has. But I don't think, I didn't see a great tie between people who associated Roy Moore with Donald Trump, even though Donald Trump came here or skirted around it sort of to support him.
Also, in the national polls, the Republican tax plan is highly unpopular. I mean, a lot of people, it's not only unpopular among Democrats and independents, it's also unpopular with Republicans who are not rich. In other words, working class, middle class, lower class folks. Is that what's the take on that in Alabama? Is that an issue there?
It really has not, but I think it's because our focus has been so dominated by this race. You almost feel like it's New Year's Day today, that you're sort of starting over with everything. So I think when we see Doug Jones take office, which is likely not going to be till 2018, the way things are going to work out, that you will see more of attention on how is he going to vote or how is he going to deal with some of these issues that come to the Senate, you know, if they make it that far. I think you'll see greater attention on details and issues, which frankly we didn't see during this election at all. There was no mention of any of this.
Did you happen to get any sense of how you feel Doug Jones is going to vote as a senator when he does take his seat? We had a little discussion earlier in the show about whether Doug Jones would have to tack a little bit to the center or if he's going to stay as a relatively progressive, especially for the South, when he reaches the Senate.
Well, progressive for the South is still conservative for most of the nation. But I think, you know, the best comparison I heard was like a Joe Manchin from West Virginia who has sort of skated around some things. He's a Democrat, but he's kind of definitely to the right. And I think that if Jones wants to win in 2 years, he's going to have to say, I am a Democrat, but first I am an Alabamian and I represent these people. Because the first sign of going with the National Democratic Party could be the kiss of death for him.
That's right.
But Connor, jump back in, because we were discussing this, Lita, in the first section. The black community, which was decisive for Doug Jones' victory, is less likely to be highly mobilizable in the next election if Doug Jones seems to be moving to the right. In other words, the black community, not only, and those who voted for Jones in large numbers, not only, as Garland had said earlier, sense the possibility of victory, and that made them enthusiastic. There's also content. There's policy content. There's social content. Won't that, like, diminish his base in the black community? Because there's Alabama, and then there's Alabama. I mean, Alabama also includes this very large black community. Go ahead. And I want both of you to jump in on that.
Yeah, I think on some level, that's a hard decision that he's going to have to make is, does he, you know, stay a little bit more left than might be, than, you know, than you might think someone might want to do in that situation in order to keep the black vote and sort of keep this tide going. But I do think on some level, Lita's right. He probably is going to have to stay rightward of, you know, he's not going to be a Bernie Sanders, I don't think.
You know, this is a question really for the broader Democratic Party, too. Time was as recently as the 1980s. When Democrats could just vote any way they wanted in Congress because it was supposed to be a big tent party, right? There were Southern conservative Democrats and Northern liberal Democrats, and they considered themselves to be Democrats, strong Democrats. But it's not really like that anymore. Joe Manchin, as Lita pointed out, is able to vote Republican on some issues. He's sort of called back into the caucus on some of the more important issues. But I wonder what kind of leeway Doug Jones is going to have to vote his conscience, or really to vote the way the people of Alabama might want him to vote.
Well, and the thing to remember, too, about Doug Jones is he's already not a typical Democrat. He's spoken out for the Second Amendment. He has, he's not come out completely against the tax plan. He said that he'd like to see more cuts for the middle class. He really only differed on the abortion issue as far as a major issue and some of the more social issues. So if he pulls that old, sort of Southern, I walk the line on certain things, but I'm going to bend a little on the other, you know, he could be a very successful senator.
One thing, though, is Joe Manchin is West Virginia. I mean, in other words, the black vote is significantly less important in
yes.
West Virginia than it's going to be in Alabama.
Well, I think it is, but I also think that, you know, whether it's black or white, we're, the sense of Alabamians want to see something done. If Doug Jones can sell this to every constituent, which I realize is an almost impossible task, but how I'm helping you, I think he can transcend that. And, you know, he's already a white Democrat, which is an anomaly in this state to start with. So I think he's in a unique position to sort of bridge that gap if he can do that, which is a very difficult task.
Lita, let me go back to where you were, where you sensed the excitement in the young African-American woman who had driven left finals to come and vote. She was enthusiastic. Who were the other people in line there with you?
Well, now, I'm in North Alabama, military community, so, you know, they're discussing Apache helicopters while they're waiting to vote, which is very common. But you saw a cross-section. There was the suburban mom. There was the elder gentleman. The turnout was across the board. And in North Alabama, generally, because we're a federal community, has good turnout. That's not a big shock. What was surprising, and I was looking at some county-by-county results, is Madison County, where I am, is the we had a large number of write-in votes, one of the largest percentages in the state. There were over 20,000 write-in votes. Well, you have to think that 99.9% of those write-in votes were not against Doug Jones. They were a vote against Roy Moore, and it certainly hurt Moore. That write-in vote turned out to be very, very pivotal for him.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, Richard Shelby is so highly respected. I saw him described on CNN this morning as Mr. Alabama. I actually have a cousin, my father's cousin, who's quite a prominent Republican attorney in Birmingham. And he told me that 20 years ago. He said that there couldn't be a contemporary politician more highly respected in Alabama than Richard Shelby. And when Richard Shelby goes public and says, I am not voting for Roy Moore, I wrote in the name of another Republican. Well, you know, people pay attention to that kind of thing. I mean, and especially when they have so much respect for Shelby, that's a green light for them to do the same thing. And I agree with Lita. I think that those votes otherwise would have gone to Roy Moore rather than Doug Jones and may have cost him the election.
And Jeff Sessions said the same thing. Jeff Sessions would not say who he voted for, which is means I didn't vote against. I didn't vote for Moore.
That's right.
So what comes next in Alabama, Connor and Lita? Where do you think this will go? Are things just going to calm down? You said it's like New Year's Day. It's the beginning. The election is over, obviously. It's a stunning development, though. I just wonder, because sometimes conventional wisdom is just so wrong. I mean, we saw that, of course, in the 2016 election. We were wrong. The Democrats were wrong that Bernie Sanders wouldn't take off. The Democrats were wrong that Donald Trump could win. Everybody else was also wrong about Donald Trump, almost everybody. Certainly, we gave up making predictions here on Loud and Clear because we were so wrong. And as I mentioned earlier, the 60s, in a way, the broad progressive 60s didn't start in New York City or Berkeley or Washington, D.C. It started in Montgomery with Rosa Parks. Is it possible that the conventional wisdom about Alabama is somewhat, you know, just wrong, and possibly there will be a new day in Alabama?
I mean, when you mentioned that before about Montgomery and the whole Rosa Parks thing, I do think on some level, I mean, that was a calculated move by Martin Luther King, trying to choose a place where it would be impactful and that type of thing, and that they would be able to get a response in that way. Same thing with Birmingham. But I do think... I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting because you're going to see so much money come into these races coming in the future. I think you're going to see Democrats mobilize. At the same time, Republicans are going to retrench and then mobilize themselves. It's going to be a very interesting year. And the fact that we have so many elections coming up, like in the next few years, just to re-litigate all this, is going to be very interesting.
Go ahead, Lita.
Well, and I was going to say, I think the conventional wisdom about Alabama has been wrong for a while. I was asked during this election, did we all ride a horse to the polls? And I had to say, no, we do not. I've never ridden a horse in my life. I don't know anybody who owns a horse. You know,
apparently,
you know.
Neither did Roy Moore. So.
Right, exactly. But the thing about it is, you know, I think the conventional wisdom that the South is sort of this backwards place, it's just no, you know, we all have our issues. But it's not, I'm not sure that Roy Moore was the best representative for either the conservative South, or I know he wasn't the best representative for either the conservative South or the more progressive South.
And I've never seen anyone wear a cowboy hat in Alabama in my life other than...
Me either. Don't own one. Yeah, don't own one.
Yeah. It usually be a camouflage baseball hat, right? A camo baseball
An
cap.
Alabama hat. Let's get things right.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Roll Tide.
That's right.
Well, the other thing I think to think about is this, and that is, you know, momentum is huge in politics. And, you know, you look next door in Louisiana, they have a Democrat there that who's in the state house. You know, it's possible that we could be looking at the Democrats in the South who haven't been able to win, you know, registrar of wills for the last 30 years, saying, hey, you know what, maybe we can get some things together and win a few seats here and there.
Yeah, if they can just get Roy Moore to run in Louisiana, they'll probably be set, because...
Maybe then get David Duke to come back.
There you go.
Well, here's the thing, though, about momentum, and it goes back to where we started this conversation. People who are not active, people who appear to be apathetic, are apathetic. There's a lot of reasons for apathy, a lot of reasons for inertness, but perhaps the principal one is people don't believe that what they do as an individual will make a difference. And when they start to believe that what they do can make a difference, if in this case, coming, you know, leaving your finals exam and driving, you know, some distance to vote and being excited about it, when people start to feel those things, that idealism, that sense of hope, that sense that they can make a difference, then they start to act. And then the whole, that's what I also mean about conventional wisdom. Like, people aren't considered a factor. The broad sort of parts of the population that are generally inert aren't considered a factor until they become active. And I just figure and think that given what's happened, that we're in this kind of dynamic mix of politics and social issues and social activism. And I just wonder whether the South, as it was in the 50s and 60s, could become not just not a backwater, but actually the vanguard of a broader nationwide movement. I just wonder if it's really going to be the South once again. Go ahead, both of you.
Well, I don't know. I don't know yet. I think it's too early to say that. But I do think it's interesting that someone mentioned Bernie Sanders, because in recent times, when did we see that sort of support from the young people? And I sound like a grandmother saying that, but the support from the college-age kids that are getting motivated and being involved, we saw that with Bernie Sanders, who was an unlikely progressive candidate for many people. And so we see a young African-American voter driving from Tuscaloosa 3 hours home to vote for a white Democratic candidate from Birmingham who's an attorney. That's a pretty interesting comparison there.
Yeah, Garland, I think it's interesting, too. I mean, I think, and that's kind of what I'm getting at, is I really believe that the old politics of the United States, the consensus politics, are collapsing, and that there's a lot of room right now for a new voice. And even Doug Jones, because I don't know much about what's going on in Alabama, I was just startled that 2 days before the election, he's on the radio, on NPR, giving what amounts to a fairly militant defense of women's right to choose. And he said, I'm about right to life when a child is born, because then it's what kind of life are they going to have? What kind of education? What kind of social existence will there be so that that child can prosper? I mean, he had a message.
And when you look at that, one of the other thing we got to look at here, and that is the fastest growing political group are independents. And they were 21% of the voters. So if you look there, I mean, we don't know necessarily the races of all the independents, but 28 to 30% of the vote was black there. 21% are independents. And the Republican presidential nominee in like 2008 won 50 or excuse me, won independence by like 50 or 60%. Doug Jones won by 9% yesterday. So one of the things we can be looking at now is the effect of independence, which takes us outside of that traditional Republican Democratic box.
Yeah, one important point also is if every single black and young person in Alabama voted, or even a sizable percent voted in every election, if that turnout was to change on a market level, these conversations would be much different. So I think. Obviously that's true anywhere in the country, but I think that now these groups are mobilizing that generally in the past did not. You could see there could be a totally different face of the electorate in the South, but and that's an unlikely result. I don't see that necessarily happening, but there's possibilities out there for a lot of different results from this.
We have not heard anything yet from Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon declared war essentially on the Republican Party and on Republican Senate incumbents, but he's not said anything yet about this race. Are we to assume, I wonder, that he's going to back off, let's say, in the race in Nevada or the race in Arizona? I would think not. I would think that this is really the beginning of the story rather than the end.
Well, the question is anyone going to actually want him to be their surrogate anymore? I mean, is this the end of his career in that sense?
It very well could be.
People could hire him to work for their opponent.
As a media type of person, but as far as a surrogate for campaigns and things like that, he might just be, pretty much, what do you call it,
washed up.
Just kryptonite in that sense.
Well, and we've already seen that today, that some national Republicans have called on Trump to distance himself from, because one of the big complaints or the big faults on the Moore campaign was not just Bannon, but every surrogate that he used or that spoke for him in the media was a disaster. I mean, the people he had speaking for him were a nightmare.
Representative Peter King tweeted, "Steve Bannon looks, quote, looks like some disheveled drunk who wandered onto the political stage."
Yeah.
So, I don't think they're feeling real. I don't think they're feeling Steve Bannon right now.
I don't think we should be putting down disheveled drunks like that.
That's right. We could get a lawsuit against them.
Karl Rove had a reputation as being a political genius. And when you look back at his two national campaigns, he actually lost the first one, right? I mean, in terms of the popular vote anyway, and barely won the second one against a weak Democrat. We can say even less about Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon ran a national campaign that lost the popular vote by more than 3 million votes. He went with, like we said a few minutes ago, all in on this Alabama Senate race and lost that.
Yeah, if you look at Breitbart, again, I want to go back to Breitbart, which isn't in his name, but he's the guy there. The number one reason that Roy Moore lost, quote, was, and this is funny, not having a unified GOP.
Well, that's interesting because
Steve Bannon has declared war on the other part of the GOP.
Exactly. And when I was watching the cable news shows while the polls were still open, the Roy Moore spokespeople were going after Republicans. They weren't going after Doug Jones. They weren't even mentioning Doug Jones. They were talking about how Mitch McConnell wasn't going to decide the Alabama election. Well, he doesn't even have a vote in Alabama, but that's where all their fire was going. And I think that's the Bannon trademark, is to attack people close to him.
Well, and it's also poor market research by Bannon. I mean, he stood up in front of a crowd in Alabama and made fun of the fact that Joe Scarborough didn't get in the same schools he did, and Joe Scarborough graduated from the University of Alabama.
Uh-oh.
No. So it was a stupidest comment. You know, now people aren't going to vote based on that, but it was sort of just another example of, you're up there saying, don't let outsiders tell you what to do, and you're the outsider.
Exactly. Very, very paradoxical.
Lita, what's it like in the newsroom where you are? I mean, we've heard from you and Connor. What about the people you work with? Are they stunned? Are they shocked? What do they think?
They're tired. We've been doing this since, I think I wrapped up the last BBC interview at 2 a.m. last night.
Yeah, you know, by the way, that's so interesting, because I heard I didn't know it was you on the interview, but the fact that this is world news, I mean, this isn't just Washington, D.C. or the national news. Or
it says
certainly
a lot.
I think I did 7 yesterday with the BBC News, and I actually sent a feeler out in the newsroom and said, who all have you talked to? And it was Japan and Switzerland and the Netherlands and South Africa, and it was just such a huge story. You know, we've seen our governor resign over a sex scandal. We've seen our Speaker of the House go to jail, which were all, you know, kind of blips on the radar, but certainly not international blips. This was huge. The mood is, you know, there's still Roy Moore, who is yet to concede, although even our Secretary of State, you know, has said a recount is not going to change the results. So now we turn to, okay, when is Doug Jones going to be sworn in? What is the process by the, you know, we've not had a new senator in a long time, other than Luther Strange, which was a different situation. It was you're appointed, you hop on the airplane, you go, you're done. You know, this is a whole new ball game for us.
Okay, we're gonna leave it there, Lita. We've been talking from Huntsville, Alabama with Lita Gore. She is a journalist with AL.com. We were also joined by Connor Sheets, another journalist. He's in Birmingham, also with AL.com. We're in studio with Garland Nixon, Mike Hirsch, John Kiriakou, and me, Brian Becker. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we'll be back with the top stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.